Good afternoon, and welcome to the closing press conference. We have with us most of the speakers who were part of the closing plenary, and we now have all of them except Keisha, who I think will be joining us as well. I think the speakers at today's closing ceremony captured the sense of momentum and hope that we feel as AIDS 2000 draws to a close. This convergence of people living with HIV/AIDS, scientists, community leaders, caregivers, and policymakers has provided a crucial opportunity for all of us to move towards closing the gap between hope of delivering prevention, care, and treatment to all, and the reality of universal access. The momentum toward that goal is tempered, though, with a growing sense of impatience with the pace of our progress. We must channel that impatience into action, leaving Toronto committed to the ideal that the world will deliver on the promise of universal access to HIV prevention, treatment, and care. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers, who will give a very brief summary of their comments, and then we'll open it up to your questions. Our hosts this week have been our conference co-chair, Mark Weinberg, and his fellow Torontonians, well, he's not a Torontonian, but his fellow Torontonians, Canadians, and the Toronto local hosts. Their warm welcome and years of planning created a wonderful atmosphere for all of us to gather and get to the business at hand. Mark's dedication to this cause and to this conference has been visible throughout. He calls for a massive scale-up of the response to the HIV pandemic. And without further ado, we'll just turn the podium over to Mark to provide an overview of the conference.
Is this working? Thank you, Helene. First, I think that I definitely do feel like a Torontonian at this point in time. And I, again, want to thank everyone associated with our local host and the City of Toronto, as well as the governments of Ontario and Canada, for immeasurable support. I think that we have made clear throughout this conference that the global demands of the epidemic require immediate response. That is why I ended with the remarks that there is no time to delay, it's time to deliver, a theme echoed, I think, by many of us throughout this week. If I can draw an analogy for you, I think it would be that of a famine. When we see people dying of starvation in some area of the world that has been devastated through lack of food and water and other resources, we generally tend to respond with generosity and with dispatch because we understand the urgency of the crisis. We understand fully well that people who do not have anything to eat or drink will not survive. It seems to me that the HIV epidemic represents exactly the same kind of situation. We have the wherewithal to save people whose lives are surely threatened unless we can bring the life-saving drugs to them in a clearly efficient and rapid manner. We have waited far too long to make this the crucial issue of our time. We have learned throughout this conference that the delivery of effective medications to people who will otherwise die will not only represent a means by which the lives of these people will be saved, but will also surely represent an important step in public health as the viral loads of the people thus treated go way down, and as a consequence, they have less virus throughout their bodies, including, importantly, in their genital tracts, and these people simply become far less infectious. It seems to me this is win-win. It is not a matter that requires debate. It means that this is a situation that demands our utmost attention. I want to say two other things. First, I really do feel gratified that many people have said that this has been an international AIDS conference that brought the science back into the level of discourse at an extremely high level. I think that is absolutely true, and I think it is incumbent on us as an international AIDS society, together with our partners, to ensure that the visibility of high-level science at these conferences stays with us in Mexico City and beyond, These conferences can only be successful if they are truly transforming in the context of bringing together the political dimension, indeed, the community dimension, indeed, but let us not forget the science and we welcome all of us the announcements of new drugs and new drug classes at this meeting that truly have the potential to make a difference in people's lives. Surely, yes, initially here in the rich country setting, but ultimately and without fail in developing countries, and all of us will agitate for that to happen, believe me. Third, and with this I will finish. I today, together with my colleague Stephen Lewis, spoke out, I think, in rather strong terms against the failure of political leadership to act responsibly in those areas of the world in which the endemic is so prevalent. And South Africa was singled out for special attention. I feel privileged, in a way, to be a university employee. I do not work at a UN agency. I do not work for a Canadian governmental agency. I do not work at any one of a number of institutions in which political correctness might dictate that I not say some of the things that I have said here as the Canadian co-chair in regard to both the absence of our Canadian Prime Minister, but also by way of direct criticism of a foreign government. After all, I know that is not diplomatically correct, but I thought it was essential. There is no time to waste, and let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, we as a world have sat back for far too long watching South Africa continue to deteriorate in terms of growing numbers of millions of people contracting HIV and a health minister who prefers to talk about lemon juice as opposed to talking about bona fide means of preventing transmission that must include pre-exposure prophylaxis and microbicides, and yes, when we have them, ultimately, vaccines. I think that is a given. It's not something that requires a PhD in political theory. It's just obvious to anyone who has spent any degree of time talking about this, and why it is that a government can continue to remain in power in a country despite all of the evidence that it has abysmally failed to deliver the essentials to its population is something that I clearly do not understand. I'm sure Mr. Lewis can speak about this with greater eloquence than myself, but it is something that burns a hole through my heart. And I say this, if you recall, as someone who assumed key responsibility with regard to organization of the conference that took place in Durban, South Africa in 2000. That was my year as president of the International AIDS Society. We went to the IAS meeting in Durban, all of us, myself, Pedro, Helene, and all of our IAS colleagues, together with our co-partners, such as ICASO and GNP Plus, and women living with HIV, all expecting that we would have a South African government that would be on side with us in ensuring that that conference would have effect. Instead, what did we find? We found a denialist president of South Africa who immediately turned his back on us and who immediately began to convene committees that would articulate on his behalf that somehow it was in dispute whether or not HIV was truly the cause of AIDS. How could a world permit this to happen? I think we were all completely bamboozled. We, the scientists, who really have very little by way of political experience and political connections and political know-how, we were completely taken aback. We were all insulted. And I think it is fair to say that 6 years later, I, for one, am no longer prepared to just take a back seat as a scientist and not express my personal concern as to the atrociousness of the fact that this situation in South Africa seems to have continued unabated, ladies and gentlemen, for all of these 6 years, bringing us here to this conference in Toronto. I certainly hope that we will manage to find a means of reversing this horrible situation within the next short while, and if our statements here can add to the political pressure that will ensure that such change takes place, I am certainly happy to be part of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll now turn it to Anders Nordstrom, who is the Acting Director General of the World Health Organization. In his remarks today, he called for medicines, money, and motivated healthcare workers. Anders.
Thank you very much. I think what this conference has been able, what we have been able to achieve during this conference are three things. First, to get a better balance in between prevention, condoms, and access to medicines. We need both, not just treatment, but we need also prevention. From my personal perspective, I think we have been talking too little about behaviors and condoms. Possibly we can do that next time. Second thing that we have achieved during this conference, I think, is the recognition of the involvement of all key stakeholders, women, definitely, young people. I think there is a general agreement today that both what we need to do, who needs to be involved, and also among the partners. It's been amazing to see the interactions in between people during the conference. People are prepared to action. But this conference is not only about a conference. This is about working together. And I think this has been a great achievement. But my third, which I think have been a great achievement from this conference, and I'm personally very happy with that, that was actually my third issue during my speech. That is about the workforce. People. It's not enough with money and drugs. We do need people in the health centers, in the hospitals, and we need to begin to talk about what are the issues. You can't train the problem. You need to pay people. That is the core, if I simplify it. We have been thinking that we can build the capacity by training. Training is important, no question about that, but that's not the answer. We need to see why are we not having the right kind of people, whether it's in the private sector, in the NGOs, or in the public sector. People are not doing that. They are driving taxis instead, or they're going to another country. And I think we need a different understanding. This was the theme of the World Health Report this year from WHO, the workforce, the crisis in the workforce. We're missing millions of health workers, and we will never be able to succeed on the universal access if we don't address this issue. I was mentioning the meeting I was in New York with the Secretary General, with the heads of some of the largest pharmaceutical companies. A lot of goodwill and readiness to move on second-line drugs, prices, pediatric formulas, etc. But what they were saying to me as well is that the bottlenecks today we have are with the distribution systems, the logistics, and the lack of staff. So I think here we would need another sort of movement and commitment here from stakeholders. This is nothing WHO will be able to solve. This goes beyond the health sector. But here, I've been very, very happy to hear that people are talking about the need for health workers, not doctors. Doctors are not going to be the answer, but a mix of different kinds of health workers that will be needed for us to be successful.
Thank you. Thank you, Anders. And I now turn it over to Stephen Lewis, who is the president of the Stephen Lewis Foundation and the UN envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. Stephen gives voice to the dreams of so many people working on a world without AIDS. His work is rooted in his deeply held belief in the shared humanity of people around the globe. He, too, has welcomed us here on behalf of the Canadian people and has been a wonderful host. So, Stephen.
Thank you, Aileen. I don't want to go over unduly what I've said. I'll be happy to participate in the questions. I think it should be pointed out that there have been many very strong and principled voices raised within South Africa against the government of South Africa. The Dr. Jerry Cravajas and the Alan Whitesides in Durban have taken enormous political principle and stated their views publicly. And the extraordinary voices of the Treatment Action Campaign, led until recently by Zaki Ahmed and by Mark Haywood, whom you heard here at the plenary yesterday, but now increasingly led by a group of remarkably courageous young women living with the virus and speaking out in a thoughtful and persuasive manner against the government. It is always, of course, rather easier for those of us who are on the outside to make these statements, which are, I suspect, largely looked at as gratuitous by the government. But the people inside who fight the good fight, they are really quite remarkable, and I feel privileged to have some of them as my friends. I was struck by the science as well, as Mark said, of the conference. I was struck in particular by the Bill Gates reference to pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a potential breakthrough, as he indicated, which has not been widely explored. And I was equally fascinated by Julio Montaner's reference to putting increasingly large numbers of people on treatment, regardless their CD4 count on the basis that if the viral load drops to undetectable levels, then obviously the transmission of the virus does not occur or occurs in at a much lesser degree. And he has costed this now and worked on it. I'm not a scientist. It will have to be peer-reviewed and subject to intense scientific scrutiny, but it seems to me that both the Gates idea and the Julio Montaner idea opened up lines of scientific inquiry which give to this conference a particular scientific notoriety which may indeed turn out to be a turning point down the road. For myself, I guess I was gratified to see the friendly audience response to the remarks, A, on abstinence, B, on harm reduction, C, on South Africa. Isn't it fascinating how a large group of people show such intense solidarity and, I think, through that, the expression of frustration about what is happening in South Africa? And finally, on women, I think this conference has given real centrality, not only to the struggle for an international women's agency, but for the primacy of women in the fight against the pandemic. You know, there were 120 sessions directly related to women's rights and women's concerns in relation to the virus. That is unprecedented over the last number of conferences. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you. Our final speaker who is with us today on this podium is Pedro Kahn. Today I turn the reins of the International Aid Society over to my friend and colleague Pedro Kahn of the Fundación Hesped of Argentina. Pedro is the first IAS president from a developing country, and I know he will bring great visibility and passion to the issues of developing countries, and particularly, as he said in his comment, to the Latin American region. I know Pedro will lead IAS well as we prepare for AIDS 2008 in Mexico City, and I look forward to joining him there as a delegate.
We will try to find out some work for you, not only as a delegate.
I'll be there as an NGO, Pedro.
Okay. So I will be very brief. I think it has been a long and very productive week, an extraordinary conference. We are very happy at IAS for being able to put together this meeting. And I think that my comments should be related to two issues. One is, what is IAS duty? I think that we are a powerful organization, I can say it today, an organization that is able to put together, I think it's the only one in the AIDS field that has the skills to build such an incredible meeting in which basic scientists, healthcare workers of all disciplines, and people living with HIV/AIDS, politicians, artists, and whatever you want to think, and obviously media, which we are very grateful to, because you help us to put again AIDS in the front lines, and this is in the headlines, and this is really a very important point. I would like to encourage you as much as you can not to forget AIDS until 2008, because AIDS is a daily killing problem. But obviously, the duty of the International AIDS Society is not only limited to gather conferences. We have to raise our voice. We have to unite our voice with other people's voices in regards to the issue of access. I just would like to point out one of the concepts of my closing remarks. We will not endorse any type of Schindler's List in which some people will select who lives and who dies. We are strongly, strongly committed with universal access. We are strongly committed to do our best in order to push that the objectives for 2008 and 2010 are accomplished, and if not, to make accountable people who are responsible for that. And we are also part of the people that are responsible for that. Our feeling is that if you are not part of the solution, you are part of the problem, and we really would like to be part of the solution. In regards to advocacy, we would like to underscore one issue that has been already mentioned by Dr. Nordstrom, and that is the healthcare worker force. You cannot overestimate the importance of this problem. As I said in my talk, a quarter of all the healthcare workers working in US, UK, Canada, and Australia come from abroad. but half of them come from developing countries. And people are leaving developing countries because of low salaries, because they have no logistics to work with, and they don't have safe environmental conditions, including access to treatment if they get infected while they are treating patients. So this is a must that we should really address, and the IAS will make out of this one of its major points. And last but not least, we are coming to Latin America with our first International AIDS Conference. Mexico has not been chosen by chance. When we look at the countries that can host the conference, we look at countries that have a very decent and a large convention center. You can say Mexico is okay. Enough number of hotel rooms. It's a logistical issue, but you need enough number of hotel rooms, and this is okay. And then you need some other issues that are not that easy to obtain, which is free speech, free traveling for people living with HIV, no criminal prosecution to drug users, to commercial sex workers, not having homophobia as an official policy. On the contrary, I can say that this is really Mexico has among his top officers in the AIDS program even transgender people, which is very good news. And I can tell you that we are very happy to go to Mexico. We are pretty sure that besides the beauties of the country, I can tell you I've been several times there. It's really a marvelous country. It's the perfect country to host this conference. Let me tell you that in Latin America, almost 2 million people are living with HIV. And by no means I am trying to diminish the importance of the epidemic in Africa, in Asia, because it's really a tragedy. But believe me, sometimes our feeling are that Latin America is a little bit being set aside in the shadow of other regions. And we want to put, again, Latin America in the agenda. The life of a young lady dying in Bolivia is as worthwhile as the life of a Canadian, as the life of an African, an Asian, etc. So I'm happy to take any questions with my fellows here. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we start the questions, I would just like to say how much we appreciate, since this is our final press conference, how much we appreciate the role that all of you who are in the audience from the media play. One of the important roles of this conference is to shine the light on this epidemic and make the world remember how important HIV/AIDS is, and to not forget that this is still one of the greatest tragedies of all humanity. So we appreciate the fact that you come, spend the time that you do to shine the light on this issue while we come together and learn and share information and go home energized. And as people said, it's important that you're here, it's important that you cover this, but it's equally important that you go back in the 2 years in between conferences and remember to keep AIDS on the map around the globe. So thank you for your role. And I will just now open it up for questions, Larry Alton. And if people will just stand so we can get the mic to you and say who you are.
Larry Alton, New York Times. Dr. Weinberg, you spoke about the robustness of the science at this meeting and returning it. Would you, in your estimation, name the 5 most important new scientific advances that were presented here at this meeting?
I think the new drug development issue is extremely important. I would list the integrase talk that was given yesterday in the late breaker as being of high importance. The robustness of the drop in viral load is really extremely encouraging and suggests that this drug may have the capacity to alter the rapidity with which HIV can reservoir itself into latency. I think this is something that will have to be followed up. It may be very profound. 2, I would say the encouraging data in regard to the entry inhibitors. We all look forward to the continuing development of this story. I think as well, some of the vaccine data here at this meeting have been very encouraging with regard to highlighting the importance of mucosal immunity. We won't have a vaccine in all likelihood unless we can better understand mucosal immunity and the challenge that it represents. I think new breakthroughs in regard to epidemiology have been key in teaching us the importance not only of how HIV is spread, but really the fact that harm reduction programs are working in every single setting in which they have been tested. I think this is key, and I think government leaders have to understand that science-based medicine is what should drive our response to the HIV epidemic. And fifth, I would say the encouraging data that we have out of this conference in regard to pre-exposure prophylaxis safety data, suggesting really that this may well be the greatest hope that we have in the near future in regard to stemming the tide. And I fully hope that the trials that have been interrupted for far too long a time, in my opinion, can now proceed and go through to completion with what I am absolutely sure will be positive results.
Over here. Right here. Keep these mics flowing. Yep.
Hi, from Mexico, Fernando Mino, La Jornada. Dr. Khan, you say that we need to put Latin America into the agenda of AIDS. What we can do that in, if in this conference the presence of Latin Americans were very small?
Well, precisely, this is my point. And let me tell you that in our minds, the 2008 conference, after a short break of the weekend, will start next Monday. We start working for the 2008 conference, and let me anticipate that we are planning with Dr. Soto Ramirez and with Craig McClure, our executive director, to visit almost every single country in the region before the conference to ignite the issue of AIDS and to increase awareness. It's, if you allow me the comparisons, it's like the Olympic flame. We want to go country by country talking about AIDS and inviting people to join us in Mexico in order to make it really a difference in Latin America. The Durban conference in year 2000 was a must for Africa. It was really a turning point. We want to make the 2008 conference in Mexico a turning point also.
Right here.
David Brown from the Washington Post. There's been a lot of talk about various interventions that are in trials now without results yet, such as circumcision, more PrEP trials, microbicides, and there's a real feeling that these may all add up to, you know, a huge, you know, summation of interventions that can make a big difference. I'm wondering if you could just comment on whether you think people are really pouring too much hope into these, or in fact they in fact could add up to a sharp corner in the history of the epidemic.
I might start by answering that. As you know, we put out a report this Tuesday from the Global HIV/AIDS Prevention Working Group talking about the new prevention technologies that are in trials. And while I think we feel a lot of optimism about the different trials, circumcision, diaphragms, herpes treatment, oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, microbicides, and ultimately a vaccine, that we also realize that none of these are going to be 100% effective, and each of these tools will work best for certain populations. So there is, I think, what we want to make sure people realize, that even with expanding the prevention options, there is no silver bullet, and we still need to have a comprehensive prevention response that includes the prevention strategies that we already know work, incorporate behavioral as well as biomedical prevention approaches, and that still has to be linked to treatment, care, and support if we're going to have the impact. I think one of the things people keep pushing is for somebody to say that there is going to be one silver bullet, and I think we have to recognize that even with these expanded options, they will have to be seen in a comprehensive way and linked to other, particularly behavioral strategies, if we're going to have the impact that we want in the long run, and that we still have to, which I think also came out loud and clear at this conference, address some of the underlying social and economic vulnerabilities that place populations at risk to begin with. So attacking poverty, gender inequities, et cetera. So while we have incredible hope for these new prevention strategies, keeping in mind that they have to still be seen in a comprehensive light, recognizing that none of them will be 100% effective, and we still have to make sure that we look at this comprehensively. Anybody else want to add anything to that?
We have one magic bullet that works.
I'd like to add just one thing to Helene. David, I trust deeply, and maybe without any critical faculties at work, the scientists to whom I chat, or with whom I chat about some of these things. And when somebody as authentic and thoughtful as Zita Rosenberg talks about the first-line trials and the second-line trials and talks in terms of 5 to 7 years for microbicide and clearly has a pretty serious grasp on what they're learning and what they're doing, I'm inclined to feel that maybe 5 to 7 years is quite real. I absolutely accept Helene's caveat that none of these interventions are sufficient of themselves or maybe even taken collectively. But if, in fact, microbicides at 60 or 70% effective can save 2 to 3 million lives over a short period of time, that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And therefore, that gives one considerable hope. If by chance the circumcision approach, and again, I'm inclined to think that the South African study seems pretty telling, and my conversation with people who know the science at UNAIDS, for example, suggests to me that that's also very real, and that Uganda and Kenya are probably likely to mirror that. Again, taken together, it feels as though we may have found, articulated at this conference, a potential turning point. We may look back on it as an important moment.
Ben, I think we will come to Mexico with considerable new options in prevention. Yes.
Monsieur Khan, je voudrais vous dire qu'il ne faut pas qu'on aille à Mexico désunis. Les ressortants des pays sous-développés. À force de dire que l'Afrique a été privilégiée par rapport à l'Amérique latine, ça risque de diminuer nos forces. Je pense qu'on devrait pouvoir partager nos expériences, aussi bien en Afrique que ce qui a été fait en Amérique. C'est vrai que des deux côtés, il y a un besoin énorme, et je pense qu'en conjuguant les efforts, on arrive toujours à vaincre les grands problèmes. Merci.
And yes, you want to just state your name and
who
you are? No, state his name and who
you are. Moi, je m'appelle Benet Jérôme, je suis du Burkina Faso, je suis journaliste dans un quotidien de l'État burkinabé.
Okay.
What the more than a question, it was a comment in regards to my previous comment about putting back Latin America in the agenda and that sometimes other regions overshadowed the situation in Latin America, and this gentleman is raising the concern that we should not fight any one region against the other, but we should work in a unified way, and we have one problem, and the problem is the same, and we should just go together and move forward, and I fully agree. By no means I meant we should forget any other region. I'm just saying, hey, we are also here, please don't forget us.
Hi, I'm Tammy Holtman from AllAfrica.com. I wonder if any of you could address the issue of what kind of immediate, practical, short-term mitigations might be made for the health worker crisis, particularly in Africa.
I mean, the very quick win is, of course, to provide treatment so that people will survive. That we can do tomorrow. I mean, some of the more bigger issues that I was talking about in terms of conditions of service, salaries, etc., that would take much more longer time. But there are also good examples. You go to Zambia, some good progress has been made there in terms of getting doctors and nurses, even more important, available out in the communities outside Lusaka. Same good experiences from Uganda as well. There's a new global alliance on workforce led by the former Ugandan colleague, Francis Omaswa. But I think, I mean, the very practical thing is now to get people on treatment. That's, then we will save lives and workforce.
Over here.
I'm inclined, you said Africa particularly, Tammy, I'm inclined, obviously I agree on the treatment, but I'm inclined to think that the crisis is of a nature that the only way to handle it significantly is to do, for example, what the UK Department of International Cooperation, DFID, is doing in Malawi. $268 million over 5 years for the purpose of increasing public service salaries, improving working conditions profoundly, doing an intense training of cadres of quasi-professional workers or community health worker level in order to be able to dispense medication and do a number of things that don't require doctors and nurses, and also to build housing, to find shelter. And what we have learned in the first year of the Malawi experiment is that the out-migration of nurses, for example, dropped almost to nothing. It was very interesting. I was speaking to the firm SEC in Malawi just yesterday, and they've had very good success with that. Zambia has a plan at $200 million a year for 5 years, a very excellent human development, human capacity plan, which, were it to be funded, would make all the difference in the world to that country in the retention of workers and in the training of new workers to overcome the gaps that exist. But that depends on the G8 delivering on its promises. $1 billion over 5 years is not a large amount of money if the amount that was promised for Africa by 2010 was delivered. And the fact that it is already falling apart suggests that Zambia is going to have to scramble for the money. The Irish are moving into Lesotho, and they're moving into Lesotho in conjunction with the Clinton Foundation, and they too are looking at serious human capacity plans. I mean, this seems to me to be the vehicle. If you can find one or two of the donors who are really serious about helping with capacity, you can move fairly quickly. And Malawi shows that. Malawi is really quite fascinating in that regard.
I think you also need to look beyond the G8. I mean, there's some other bilaterals that are prepared to put out that kind of money now.
I know of Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Luxembourg, Holland.
Netherlands.
Am I missing one?
Netherlands.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Norway.
No.
Question over here.
Yes, my name is Jerry Green. I'm a medical doctor and journalist in Toronto. I just spoke to Dr. Ramirez and the Minister of Health of Mexico, and they seem very interested in having complementary and alternative medicine form a major part of the next conference, and we're very pleased about that, and I'm just wondering what the resistance here has been for this area. There are many countries around the world that use natural things, whether it's Mexico, India. Dr. Ribello is here from India and was a presenter at this conference. That is a tribute to the conference. There was a small get together on selenium as a complementary method in addition to HRV, showed in a double-blind study to be effective in changing the blood status of AIDS people. So I'm just trying to understand what it has been the resistance to this in North America of including this.
Yeah, there's no resistance to including it in the conference, and we are very happy to have abstracts submitted, satellite sessions that provide science to that looks at this as an issue. And so a lot of the conference is obviously driven by what people submit and what information and who asked to have satellite conferences, et cetera. I think we're very willing to have more focus on science related to complementary and alternative medicine.
Well, that's good.
Next
but it just
only one question per. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. What? No. I'm working the room. Working the room. There's their hands coming up. Sorry.
My name is Jay Rodriguez, Gazeta Brasil in Toronto. My question goes to Mr. Stephen Lewis. As we know, Brazil has an amazing AIDS prevention program. Is it possible to apply the Brazilian program in Africa?
You know, we have actually tried to marry some of the Brazil experience with Africa. In fact, one of my colleagues who's in the room now accompanied the Minister of Health of Lesotho to Brazil to meet with the Brazilian health authorities and to see to what extent the Brazilian experience could be used in Africa. And you will know that the Brazilian experience is being used to some limited extent in both Mozambique and in Angola. I would think that if Brazil could at some point provide very low-cost drugs, that might be of help to some of the African countries. And if it could do some training of health professionals and fill in some of the gaps. When I was recently in Mozambique, we met with the Minister of Health at some length, who had been trying to work things out with the Minister of Health in Brazil, but it was difficult. There are just limits on the number of people you can bring. And there is an effort, though. There is a serious effort, so much as I've been able to observe, to involve Brazil in the life of the response to AIDS in Africa.
Thank you.
My name is Zulfi Kasha. I'm from Pakistan. So I would appreciate Dr. Mark and Stephen Levice for coming up with boldness and courage referring to the countries like South Africa. But I would like to know that your comments referring to countries like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia, that this is a complete denial. They think that, you know, this is not our issue because we are Muslims, so this is not our issue and we have very low prevalence. So, you know, since you have emerged like an international leadership of fighting against AIDS, so I would like to have your comments about these countries as well. And the second thing is I would like to ask you people that how to bring media as a partner to fight against HIV, because during this conference I can see the very few sessions on media. There was a session on media and AIDS, but that was addressed mostly by the media commercial giants coming from TVs and all that. But how to bring the media, because I think if you wanted to make it universal access with treatment and prevention by 2010, you need to have a media as a partner. And so you think about it strategically to bring it smarter, and how you are bringing it in the next conference. Thank you.
I think you addressed that to myself and to Stephen Lewis. I would only respond briefly by saying that every country in the world is affected by the HIV epidemic, and in those countries that have state-imposed religion of sorts, it is fair to say that people throughout the world who profess to adhere to any particular religion will on a daily basis violate some of the most sacred tenets of that religion and will lie about it. I think Mr. Lewis, who is probably far more religious than I am, is better prepared to answer the question.
Oh, yes, I'm... I'm so profoundly non-religious, it is worth having a titter run through the audience. I think I address South Africa because that's where I do my work. I do my work in Africa. I wouldn't pretend to begin to comment on South Asia. I just can't do that. There is an envoy, a UN envoy for Asia. Her name is Nafis Sadiq. She's the former head of the UN Population Fund, and she speaks with enormous force and intelligence about what's going on. I'm simply not informed about South Asia. I'm sorry.
Last question.
Thank you. I am Diana Mendoza from Mexico, and this question is to Mr. Nordstrom. I'd like to know what is necessary and whether the WHO would lead an initiative to pass from the evilization of pharmaceutical industry to a workable framework that would make it a business instead of charity to have access for medicines when obviously there is volume there, one of the two variables in business. Also for Mr. Ken, I'd like to know how are you going to address the loud call for transparency in the selection of abstracts for Mexico 2008? And from the co-chairs, I would like to hear what's the official explanation as to why a full continent was excluded and how can this conference can be called a success when all Hispanic Latin America outside Brazil was excluded from this conference.
First of all, I would like to say that it's not true that Latin America was excluded from this conference. I think this is a too much strong statement. Probably we should have had more visibility. It also depends on the abstract that people submit. Heli was very clear about that, addressing other journalists' question. And it depends on the quantity. It also depends on the quality. And I can assure you that we will do our best to encourage people to submit abstracts. And we have
also a process at IIS in which we are in some way mentoring people that don't know how to submit abstracts. We have a process of mentoring that has been put in place in this conference, and we will expand it for the next conference. But we will not sacrifice the quality of the science that we would like to see in Mexico on behalf of having more abstracts for any given region. We need more, but we need more quality science.
Yes. Two quick answers in terms of access to drugs. Two things concretely that we're doing from WHO perspective. One is, of course, to continue the dialogue with the pharmaceutical industries in terms of the prices, accessibility. What are boundaries today in terms of access to drugs, in terms of licensing drugs, showing that there are opportunities with the TRIPS agreements that countries de facto can use. There was a big commission that worked for 1.5 years on innovation research and intellectual properties. We're taking forward that now through an intergovernmental working group and negotiating process and providing the opportunities to see how can we ensure that access is achieved even better than we do today. So, yes, we can do more than we're doing today, and there is quite a strong agenda on that right now.
I need to point out that many of our committees did include people from many South American nations. We tried to be inclusive. One of the co-chairs of our scientific committees was Dr. Horacio Salomon of Buenos Aires. I can't remember all the names, but I know for a fact that Mabel Bianco, we had many, many people from South America serving as members of our committees for the makeup of this conference.
Yeah, and just to go on record, we exclude nobody from any region or any country, but I think it's fair to say that we still need to work on making sure that we make this even more representative than it is. I think this conference has come a long way in terms of inclusiveness in all ways. So I know, Stephen, you had one last comment you wanted to make before we start wrapping up.
Yes, I'd like to use this opportunity to just expand briefly on one thing I said during my remarks at the plenary. In 26 days' time, the exemption under the Canadian Narcotics Act expires, which allowed the InSight Clinic in Vancouver, the safe injection site facility, to remain open. Now that the government has decided to make a series of announcements about AIDS after the conference is over, I would make an appeal to Prime Minister Harper to include in those announcements an explicit decision on the part of the Government of Canada to extend the life of the InSight safe injection facility in Vancouver, which is supported overwhelmingly within the city by the city municipality, and by all the surveys show a majority of the citizens, and apparently beyond. The only group I can see that is determinedly opposed is the International Narcotics Control Board, with whom I've had a rather unpleasant exchange, which I shall table sometime next week, based on a speech that I've made in Vancouver and their response. But I think this is a terrifically important issue, because if Canada does not extend the InSight facility, it means that we are adopting the war on drugs mentality of the United States, and we are moving even further down the road in that direction, with great damage, I think, to injecting drug users for whom this is a public health problem in Canada. So given that there will be an announcement forthcoming in the next very few days from the government, let the extension for the InSight facility be a part of that, and let the government demonstrate that it supports harm reduction, does not capitulate to the insistence of United States political impulses, and takes a stand.
Thank you. And before we close, I just have one final announcement. As was said earlier in one of the sessions, the conference co-organizers are very grateful to the hotel workers who did not strike during this conference. However, over the past 2 days, 52 hotel workers have been suspended for wearing a red ribbon associated with their union buttons. And I think some of the hotel workers are here. And I just wanted to say, if there are people who wanted to talk to them about what has happened to them in the course of the last couple of days, they are happy to have an opportunity to talk with the media. Again, thank you all for being here. Thank you for covering this conference. And we appreciate you keeping HIV/AIDS visible on the radar screen here, but we hope that you continue over the next 2 years until we meet again in Mexico. Thank you very much.